All right, we're beginning here on the top of Membed Amud Aleph, seven lines down. Ha'ud Amar Le Chavre, person says to his friend, Havli Me'azuze, the Masikna Bekha, give me the 100 zuz that I lent to you, Ve'hashtara, and here is the document that evidences the fact that you owe me the money. Amar Le, Piraticha, he says back to him, I already paid you back. Amar Le, Hanu Sitrayninu, that was for another loan. Yeah, you paid back that money, but that was for something else. That has nothing to do with this shtar that's in front of us. Amar of Nachman, itra shtara. Nachman says, you have diminished the power of the shtar. You have ruined the shtar in this situation. Rav Papa Amar, lo itra shtara. Rav Papa says, the shtar remains intact. Now, as far as what it means to be itra shtara, the Balei HaTosafot already quote, you can see it in the Rabbeinu Chananel as well. Perish Rabbeinu Chananel, v'chein Rabbeinu Tam, tzarech bala shtar shvua shalon shnifra. What it means, itra shtara, is that it's been degraded, but if you wanted to say the shtar was invalid, you would have said batel shtara. That's not what it says. It says itra shtara, which means that the shtar was degraded. And if it was degraded, it means now we won't let the creditor collect without a shvua. Normally a shtar would be enough evidence for you to collect with it, but now that the shtar has been degraded, we're going to force you to take a shvua on top of the shtar. Remember before, Rav Papa was of the opinion on Daf Memalef Amud Aleph, Amar Rav Papa, I'm on the offic shtar of Chavre, Amrulei shtari parua, Amrune le'elav ko kaminach, zil shlim. Tell him go pay it back, unless he makes a claim that he wants a shvua substantiated, then we will allow the shvua to come about. So Rav Papa is of the opinion here that a shtar comes with a lot of power, and that shtar is your best mechanism for protecting yourself, and therefore Rav Papa over here says that the shtar is still intact. There was nothing in here, or there's nothing done to undermine the shtar, whereas Rav Nachman believes that the shtar was ruined by the fact that he admitted that he took money. And why did he take the money? Must be because he was paying back the shtar. Now, we're going to see in a second that there are edim to the payment. There were witnesses to this payment, but the guy never requested the shtar back in that payment. The creditor admits he received the payment, but he's claiming it has something to do with another loan, nothing to do with this shtar. So Rav Nachman says the shtar has been compromised here because the guy agrees that there was a payment made. In all likelihood, it was for the repayment of the loan that stayed in the shtar. But Papa says, how do you know? There was nothing ever stated. There was no reference to the shtar. The guy's saying it was for another loan, and all we have are edim telling us that the money was paid, but it has nothing to do with this shtar necessarily. It was never mentioned in the transaction. For that reason, the shtar remains intact. Itra shtara, again, Rabbeinu Chananel and Rabbeinu Tam say that the bala shtar has to take a shvua, and then he can collect with it. But you can see, way at the bottom of the Tosfot, okay, nira, the shtar areya, lo mikra karinanei, lo mikva gavinanei. Tosfot brings an alternate opinion, it's the opinion of the Rif, which is that the shtar is, in essence, batel, or goes into suspension when you get itra shtara, which is we're not going to allow you to collect with this shtar, we're also not going to rip up the shtar. We're going to leave it there and see if any other evidence surfaces or we find something else out. It's in this limbo state, but you don't have a right of collection, as opposed to the Rabbeinu Tam or Rabbeinu Chananel, who think itra shtara still grants you the right of collection, you just have to make a shvua. You can see this in Rabbeinu Chananel, Klomar, Afilu Katuv Vishtar Nemanut. Even if the shtar has written in it that the debtor believes the creditor no matter what he says, Eino Gova Elo Bishvua, he still can only collect with a shvua. So even if the shtar empowers the creditor that he has believed if he said he wasn't paid back, nevertheless, in this case, he will require a shvua. Detakinan, Miktani Itra Shtara, Lo Kanatani Iftil Shtara. Because it says that the shtar was degraded, but not nullified. So that means that the shtar still has some power, it just needs a little extra to get it to work. And that is that you require a shvua to make it function, but otherwise the shtar can be used to collect. So those are the two sides about what itra shtara means. Rapapa, Maishna. Now Rapapa over here says that the claim of the creditor is a reasonable claim, and that the shtar is intact. How is this different than another case where Rapapa says the shtar is invalid? Mehaud amar le lechavre. The individual said to his friend, Havli me'azuze de masikne b'cha. Give me the 100 zuz that you owe me. Vashtara. And here again is the evidence through the shtar. Amalei, lava tore yahavatli. Didn't you lend me that money to enter into a business transaction? Va'atit, vitevet, amischata, V'kabalit zuzach. We went in together in a partnership to purchase shvarim, oxen, to raise them, and then to sell them for their meat. And we did that. You got your money back. After I sold it with the butcher, you got your money from the butcher based on the transaction and the partnership that we're in. V'amalei hanu sitraininu. Those were a repayment for another loan or another issue. V'amar apapa itrosh toro. And here, Rav Papa says that the shtar is degraded, that there is something wrong with the shtar in this case. What's the difference between the cases whereby Rav Papa over there says the creditor's claim is reasonable, and over here he says that the shtar is degraded? Hotam came into Kamar Atorei Yahavatli Umitorei Shakalt. Over there where the debtor says, you gave it to me for the shvarim, and you got repayment from the shvarim, itrash shtaro. The creditor admits to everything that is being said. Creditor admits that they were in a partnership for the shvarim. He admits that he got money back through a shechting of the shvarim, but he's saying that that was for another repayment or another loan. But he's admitting in general to all the facts of the case. And that really puts him in a much more precarious position, because he agrees that the shtar says they went into business together and that he was going to get paid back. And sure enough, everything that happened is exactly what is stated in the shtar. The only thing he says is, when I got the money back from the selling of the shore to the butcher, that was for another loan. Hocha, imor itrusadayanu. In the other case, when the creditor just says they came for another payment, the shtar was never involved in that conversation. Because the shtar just evidences a loan. He gets repayment in front of Edim, shtar never mentioned. Nobody has any idea what the relationship between the monies repaid and the shtar are. That we don't have any evidence of, because he didn't require the shtar back. What's written in the shtar had nothing to do with the repayment. There was never a correlation or connection made between the repayment and the shtar. He makes a claim with the shtar. The guy pays back money in front of Edim, and there's no mention of a shtar in that repayment. So you can bifurcate and say the shtar is about one loan, and this is a repayment for another loan. Over here, you have a shtar that says that they went into business together, that they were going to buy shvarim together, and they're going to repay from the meat. And sure enough, the guy agrees. That's exactly what happened. So in that case, the statement of the shtar is being corroborated by the creditor. I got my money back through the butcher. And it looks like he is agreeing that he got his money back through a butcher, which would be exactly what the shtar stated. And then he's making a claim, which is a new claim, basically, that that was for a different loan, or that it was not connected to this shtar. That's very difficult to argue in this case. Everything points to the fact that this was a fulfillment of his obligations under the shtar, and unless he made the claim up front, it's very hard to argue that sitraininu, that's as if he opened a new claim after the shtar was repaid. And that's why Papa believes here, itrash shtaro, whereas in the other case, he believes that the shtar remains intact. My havi alot, what's the halacha with regards to this? Papi amar lo itrash shtaro. Papi says that the shtar was not compromised. Rav Sheshit Brei Davidi amar itrash shtaro. On the other hand, Rav Sheshit Brei Davidi says it was compromised. The Hilchata and the Locha is Itrash Torah. The shtar is compromised over here. Here, I mean, in the case of Marv Nachman versus Rav Papa. In the second case, even Rav Papa agrees that it's Itrash Torah. So the question is, in the Machloka between Rav Nachman and Rav Papa, what is the Locha? And here the Gemara says that the Locha is like Rav Nachman, not surprisingly, because it's Dinim, and we say we always favor Rav Nachman when it comes to Dinim. And here the Gemara does that by saying that Itrash Torah, but he says, V'hani mile de pari v'ape sadeh. Even Rav Nachman agrees that this is only true when he repays the loan in front of Edim. Velo idkar le'shtara. And the debtor never makes mention of the shtar. So in that case, we still say that itrash shtara, because all evidence points to the fact that he's repaying the loan with the shtar, and he has evidence of the repayment. And the creditor doesn't have a right to say that they belong to a different loan. If they did, he should have mentioned it at the time, because he made the claim through the shtar. He says, you owe me the money through the shtar. And the guy says, I already paid them back. So his claim is coming through the shtar, and there was a repayment. So that's what degrades the shtar. Aval pare ben didei ledidei. On the other hand, if he pays him back privately, there's no evidence of the payment. At this point, since the creditor could have denied the whole transaction, could have said, you never paid me at all, now when he says, you did pay me, but you owe me for a different loan, he is believed, because if he wanted to lie, the better lie would have just been to say, you never repaid the money, and he has no evidence of the fact that he repaid the money. So now, when he says, you repaid the money, but they belong to a different loan, there he has believability because of that migo. Similar to a case that's found in the Gemara in Tubot that involves a case of a Yumi Braid Rabbi Abo, that a case like this came before him whereby the creditor is believed because there's no evidence of the repayment. When there's no evidence of the repayment, the creditor gets a huge upper hand because he can always deny the repayment. Therefore, if he tells us other information, we're going to believe him because if he wanted to lie, he would just deny it completely. Right now, the Gemara continues and says, "How damar le chavre, mhemet li kol ema damart li lo perano." The debtor empowers the creditor and says, "You are believed if you say I did not pay it back." Azal parei ba pesade. Then he goes and pays him back in front of edim. Baiv Rava b'amrei tarvayu. Hahemet. Baiv and Rava say, "What does it matter that he paid him back in front of edim? He empowered the creditor to say that you didn't pay me back." So the creditor comes and says, you didn't pay me back. Doesn't matter that he has evidence through Edim that he paid him back because he empowered the creditor and the creditor has the upper hand here. Matki flo Rapapa. Rapapa questions this logic. Of course he empowered him and he believed him more than himself. If it's the debtor's word versus the creditor's word would trump. Tvemi sade mim hemne? Since when do you believe him more than Edim? Edim in general are powerful in court to the point where if they didn't come and speak, we believe them. When he said, I believe you, the creditor, you're empowered to determine whether it was paid or not paid back, that's when it's me versus you. That's the debtor versus the creditor. Creditor trumps. If I say it was repaid, you say it wasn't repaid, I'm going to pay you. But if I pay back in front of a deem and I said I believe you, that meant I believe you against me. I don't believe you against what is incontrovertible evidence like a deem. Then the Edim are going to trump, and you can't make a claim now that I empowered you. How damale the chavre, hemet li kebet tre. So now he empowered the creditor even in a greater extent. In the previous case, he empowered the creditor to say whether the payment happened or didn't happen. Over here he says, you creditor have the power like two Edim. Yes, he's giving, in order to get the loan, he's willing to have the empower the creditor. This is what he's in the contract. In order to get the loan, the creditor makes the debtor agree that if the creditor says it wasn't repaid, then he will be believed, like as if he was to Edim. Happens all the time. When people need money, they borrow it under terms, whatever the terms are. These are the terms that the creditor is dictating. That was the first case. This case is that I believe you like to Edim. Koemat amart lo parana. And I would believe you like to Edim anytime you say it wasn't paid. Azal pare ba'ape tlato. He went and paid it back in front of three people. So he obviously is trying to get around the problem of the evidentiary power that the creditor has. So he trumps that by paying it back in front of three instead of two. Amar Papa kebetre hemne, kebetlata lo hemne. Papa says he believed him like two. He didn't believe him like three. So that means that the three should trump in this case. And that means that his evidence overcomes the empowerment that he gave to the creditor. Amalei Rav Huna Breda Rav Shua the Rav Papa Imur da Amrei Rabbonon Dazlinan Bata Rov Deot Hani Mile the Inyan Umdena the Kamad Nefishe Bikie Tfei. The other gear says Bikie Tfei Aval the Inyan Edut Mea Ketre Utre Kemea. When you deal with evidence in a case, we know that witnesses or the number of witnesses don't matter. What matters is the number of katei edim that you have, the number of groups of edim that you have. A group of two edim and a group of 100 edim against each other are equal as far as the law is concerned. If you have three sets of edim versus one set of edim, then that makes the difference. But in any case where you have offsetting edim, which is you have one group and another group, we don't look at the number of edim in the group, we just look at the unit as being a kat edim. So he says, I don't understand, Rapapa, what you're suggesting over here. You're suggesting because he has three, that trumps two. Here you're talking about edim. Three edim in a kat versus two edim in a kat. There is no evidence over here or nothing that would tilt the evidence or outweigh the set of edim that are two. You have one set of edim, another set of edim, you're now flat. You are in a situation where you can't do anything with it. Where we do see that there is such a thing is in Umdana. When you're talking about an assessment, when you're trying to value something or assess something, over there the numbers matter. And that is if people say that you need three or you need four, you need five, or if you have four or five, we believe that you're going to get a better estimate of the value of the object. The more people that assess it, the better your outcome will be in those situations, because every person has a slightly different view. The more people you get, the better you're going to get an assessment of price, because the average of all those prices, or the median of all those prices, is going to get you to something that is a fair market value. So in that case, numbers matter, or quantity of edim matter. But in cases where you're dealing with simple evidence or statements, there the number of edim don't matter. So he says, I don't really understand, Rav Papa, what does repaying in front of three have anything to do with repaying in front of two? Just as an aside, even if you believe that they are equal, that still puts you in a stalemate. And that says that nothing will happen in the case. He says, I paid back in front of three. The creditor says, you believe me like two. So that means that they each have a kat edim on their side. The creditor, because he's believed like two, and the debtor, because he gave back in front of three. He has a kat edim supporting him. So what many of the Rishonim point out over here is that when he empowers the creditor, that means that in any situation in which the evidence is flat, the creditor trumps. When he says you're believed kabei trei, doesn't just mean that you're believed like two edim. That means if you bring two edim to oppose me, I still have the upper hand in that case. And that's what it means you're believed like bei trei. Not that it means, oh, if you bring two edim and I'm bei trei, that we're flat now, because that doesn't give the creditor any advantage. Creditor wants an advantage. That advantage means that unless you can undermine my position, then I am believed. So in a case where you bring just another kat of edim against me, you haven't undermined my position, and therefore I'm going to be believed in that case. That's what you have to say here. Otherwise, what does it matter that they have three versus two and they're equal, because then you can't do anything in the case. It's a stalemate. Lishna Achrina, another version of this interaction between Rav Papa and Rav Huna Brei de Rav Yeshua. How damar le the chabrei memet li kebei trei? Koema tamart lo parana. So he says, you are the debtor empowers the creditor in extending the loan, that the creditor will be believed to him like two edim, and that if he says the loan wasn't paid, he'll have to pay it. Also apare ba'apei tlate, went and repaid him in front of three. Amar apapa kebei trei emne, kebei tlata lo emne. He believed him like two, but he didn't believe him like three. Matki flar ravuna breder Yeshua, trei kemeya, umeya kitrei. Why should it make a difference when you have one kat versus another kat of edim? Doesn't matter how many edim are in the kat. The amar le kebei tlata. On the other hand, if he says that we are believed like three, ba'azo pare ba'ape be'arbo, and then he paid him in front of four, kevi the nachat the deot, nachat the deot. Once you already start to make numbers valuable, then numbers become the game here. Which is that if he wanted to believe him like edim, all he would have to say is, I believe you like a set of edim, which is two edim. The minimum set of edim is two. When he already says, I believe you like three, that's not a necessary statement. He could just said, I believe you like two. When he says, I believe you like three, it's clear that numbers are the game now. I believe you up to a quantity of three. But that means if I can bring in four, then I'm going to trump you in that case. Because if it was just about edut, he should have just said, I believe you could betray. Three are no more significant than two. That doesn't give you anything more than you would have had as trusting with an instance of two, as we saw before in Edut. So it must be that quantity is starting to play a game here. So if you already said three instead of two, that shows that numbers make a difference. And once numbers make a difference, four will trump three. And that's what the game will be, is how many edim can you bring to offset the empowerment that you gave to the creditor. And there, even Rav Huna Brei de Rav Yeshua will agree in that case. All right, now we move on in the Mishnah to what is a extremely difficult sugya, because it involves a major machloket in the Rishonim as to how to deal with this situation. It has a serious nafkamino to halacha, which is Einish Bayim Atanat Cheresh Shoteh V'Katan. You cannot take a shvua on a claim that originates from a Cheresh Shoteh V'Katan. These are all individuals who do not have dat or not bar dat. And we also do not cause the katan to take a shvua. My time, what's the reason behind this? Amar kra ki itain ish el reyu kesef okelim lishmor. The pasuk which begins the parshia of shvua begins in the following manner. How did the shvua come about? Because ish, an individual, gave to his friend kesef okelim. Ve'ein itinat katan kum. Since the giving or the exchange or transaction with the katan is not valid, there's no such thing as a nitina for a katan, So he can't generate the scenario or circumstances that would obligate you in a shvua. So if the psukim in Parshat Mishpatim begin, ki den ish oreyu kesev ukelim, then afterward there's a denial, and then you have to have a shvuat Hashem. So that all starts or is precipitated by netinat ish. Katan doesn't have a netinah, and therefore he can't generate the framework in which there's going to be a shvua. Aval nishbaim lekatan ulekdesh. And this is the big problem in our Mishnah. We noted it when we read the Mishnah. You do take a shvua to a katan or to hekdesh. Now the obvious problem is v'amart reisha einishbaim altanat cheresh shotev katan. Didn't we already say that you cannot be obligated to make a shvua on the claim of a cheresh shotev katan? Rashi over here explains, it's really Rashi from the Mishnah, but it's here that cheresh, obviously if he can't speak, how does he have a tana? The tana must be that he does it through sign language or through indications that he communicates with us. But there's still a deficit here in a cheresh shotev katan because they're all considered not to be bardat. If they're not bardat, so they can't generate the framework in which you have to take a shvua. How do you ever have a situation in which the Mishnah says, nishbayim the katan alekdesh? How could you be taking a shvua to a katan? If a katan can't make a claim that generates a shvua, then how is there a circumstance, the Mishnah says, where you're going to be taking a shvua to a katan? That's the very basic question. Amarav veba betanat aviv. It's when he comes with his father's claim. So in essence, what you've done here is overcome the problem of netinat ish by having someone else do the netina. The other person doing the netinah was his father. His father created the situation. His father now passed away. And now the katan is coming based on his father's netinah and demanding a shvua. Ve'Rebbi Eliezer ben Yaakov. And is authored by, or the position is, Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov's position. Detanya, we have a brighter. Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov Omer. Pe'amim shadam nishba al tanat atzmo. There's sometimes where a person will actually take a shvua based on his own claim. Ketzad, what's that situation? Amarlo manet lavicha biyadi. He says to the katan, listen, I have 100 zuz, which your father had lent me, vechaltiv pras, and I paid back half of it. Harizeh nishba. That person has to take a shvua. So what Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov, in essence, is saying is, you created a modeh v'miksat case. You said that I borrowed money, 100 zuz, and I repaid 50 of those zuz. So I generated a situation of modeh v'miksat. Was there a claim here? Nobody had the claim. The claim came from your admission that the father lent you that money. So as Rashi notes over here, you can see this. Rashi says, v'katana pa b'tanat aviv lo gara mitanat atzmo d'hocho. That a katan that comes with the claim from his father is no different than the person who admits that the loan was given to him. They're both on the same playing field because there is no real claimant in the case. There's no claimant in the case of the katan because the katan doesn't have the power to make claims. Yet, we are going to still say that you have to take a shvua to the katan. That's the scenario where basically you create the problem. You create the problem by whatever your claim is. The situation that Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov speaks about is that it all comes from you. You say, I borrowed 100 and I paid back 50. Now you generate a modeh b'miksat on yourself and now you have to take a shvua to the katan. In the case of the katan, he says, the katan says, my father lent you 100. The guy says, yes, but I paid you back 50 or I paid him back 50 already. In that situation, in both cases, the claimant doesn't really exist. The only thing that happens is that this individual's admission to the fact that he owed the full amount and repaid half of it generates a motive miksat. And Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov says, that is a situation in which you're going to take a shvua of motive miksat. Chamim say, he's like giving back an aveda and he is patur. Meaning that whatever he admits to is free money. Because otherwise there's no claimant. If there's no claimant, then there's no claim. And the only thing that you're going to get is what this person admits to. And it's the equivalent of Meshiva Veda. If you remember in the Mishnah, Rashi says it's Meshiva Veda, like the Meshiva Veda Gitin, which means there's a Tikkun Olam, that you don't take a Shwa Meshiva Veda. The Baalei Tosafot disagreed with that and said it has nothing to do with the Tikkun Olam and Gitin, but simply Meshiva Veda is this guy is giving money that he doesn't otherwise have to admit to. The fact that he admits to the money, you can't take whatever he's giving you because you have nothing more claim against him. Gemara says, Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov, late meshiva beida patur. The Leiz ben Yaakov doesn't, according to Rashi, subscribe to the Tikkun Olam of Gidin, or going to Bali to support, doesn't think that this is just free money because there's no claimant over here and there's no claim over here. So now we have two answers. The first answer is Rav, and then later on in the daf we'll see that Shmuel gives an answer. Amar Rav, bishita ano katan. It's a case where the katan makes a claim. Mar says, katan. Amar, then he's boy matanat cheret shoteve katan. What does the claim of the katan do for you if the Mishnah tells you that a katan has zero power? Then has zero power, then what if you help me that the katan came? As Rashi said before, a katan and tanat atzmo are no different. They are equated. So what did you do by adding in the katan? Olam gadol. No, we're speaking to someone who's of age. The amai karul a katan. So then why do they call him a katan? Dilagabe mile davua katan hu. Because in the matters of his father, he is a katan. Because the situation is that the father transacted, the father had all his business dealings, the son isn't aware of them. So he is the equivalent of a katan in his father's business dealings because he just has no information or knowledge about what his father did. But that means that the katan here is not a real katan. We're speaking about someone who's of age who has a right of claim. Iochi tanat atzmo. Then why did Rabbi Lezer ben Yaakov claim that the situation was a tanat atzmo? Tanat acherim hi. It's a case where someone else is making the claim. It's not here coming about because the debtor admits to what happened. There is a real claim here. The real claimant is this child who is of age. Tanat acherim, behodat asmo. When you have a claim from another party, and then he admits to a portion of it, then in that case, of course, you're chayav kulu nami tanat acherim behodat asmo. That's every case that you are speaking about modav b'miksat. That's classic modav b'miksat. Somebody makes a claim, and then the defendant admits to a portion of it. And here you're no different. You're admitting to a portion of a claim that's against you from a claimant who is empowered. And the claimant here is a gadol. So how could you explain Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov's position in that way, or how can you claim that that's tanat atzmo? So now here you have a major machloket in the Rishonim, and it revolves around the girsa. The girsa here is ela bidraba kamiflege. Ella, as we know in the Gemara, always means we just rejected what we're going to say, and now we're going to go and move on in a different vein. That's exactly how Rashi reads it. Ella, udolam bitono katan. You can see that in Rashi says that the katan made the claim over here. We're going back to our original assumption that it's not a gadol, but it was a katan. That's what ella bidirabu kamiflege, and obviously that's going to have bearing on what you say afterwards. There are other Rishonim, especially like the Rimigash, who has a different view of the Sugya, but his view of the Sugya is helped by the fact that his Girsa is not Ella Bidraba Kamiflagi, Ella Hochi Bidraba Kamiflagi. Over here, they're arguing about Rabba. The difference between them is fundamental in understanding what you think a Tanat Katan is. In the end, is a Tanat Katan something, or is a Tanat Katan a zero? And that's basically the Machloket Rishonim over here. And you can see that, I'll send out the Mikorot on this, but the Rishonim basically line up on different sides here as to what does the Tanat Katan do? Is the Tanat Katan as if it doesn't exist? And if it doesn't exist, you have to continue to explain this Gemara as being about a Gadol. Because a Katan doesn't do anything and his claim is meaningless. On the other hand, if you believe that a Tanat Katan may not be powerful enough to be a full-fledged claim, but backed up by the netina of his father, together with the Tanata Katan, maybe we can create something which is strong enough to demand a shvua of you. And that will be the version of the Gemara that we have over here, which is Ela b'derabu kamiflagi. You can see that in Rashi. He says, Miu hocha tanahi da'ika netinatish. What Rashi says is, yes, generally a claim of a Katan is meaningless. But here he has the backing of his father, because his father is the one who entered into the transaction. So he has netinat ish. To be koach netinat av hi ba'a. He basically becomes a proxy of his father's netina. Therefore his claim is valid even though he is a katan. And that netina is enough. Or in essence, the machloket comes down to whether the netina is the pivotal issue in the case, which means that as long as the netina was done by a gadol, then the katan is just simply going, look at that netina, and that is my claim over here. So he's basically exercising an option to use his father's netina, and that's what makes it into a good claim. Or is the claim what generates the obligation over here? if it's the claim that generates the obligation, it doesn't matter that the father gave it. Claimant is not a claimant that can make a claim. And in that case, you would have the other gersa in the Gemara over here, which is we wouldn't go back to saying it's a katan. Unlike what Rashi says here, that the katan is the claimant, you would have to say it was still a gadol that's making the claim. Otherwise, you don't have any claim. The Rimi Gash does go on to explain, because a tanat katan is meaningless, and therefore all this is based on cases where you need a taina to generate the chiyuv. Modu b'miktzat atana, or shvat eid achad, which according to the Rimi Gash, both stem from a need for a taina, and that taina is lacking over here when you have a katan, therefore the individual is patur from the shvua, or is gemeshiv avidah, although he does say, like what we mentioned yesterday, that you do have to take a shvuat aseit in this case, because the Chachamim instituted a shvuat aseit in these matters when there is no shvuat ha-Torah. But he says, by shvuat ha-Shomrim, again, we saw as a machloke 2 days ago, that you do have to take a shvuat, even if you were shomer for a katan, because shvuat ha-Shomrim does not derive from a tana, but rather derives from the fact that you are a shomer. And you don't need any claim for the shvuat ha-Shomrim. And so, without a claim, and with katan who has no claim, you still have shvuat ha-Shomrim. That goes back to the machloket as to whether shvuat ha-Shomrim requires a tana, whether a katan can precipitate it, and whether shvuat ha-Seid has application by shvuat ha-Shomrim. Over here, the Rimi Gash believes that it is even a shvuat ha-Oraita for shvuat ha-Shomrim, because you do not require a tana at all. Now, what is Bidrabakum? If again, this is the very famous Rabbah that appears in Baba Kama, Baba Metziah, Ketubot, Gittin. It's very famous because it explains the reason behind the Shvat, Modeh Miksat, in the Torah. Dama Rabbah, Bnei Ma'amara Torah, Modeh Miksat, Atana, Yishava. Why does the Torah say that when you're Modeh Miksat, you have to take a Shvua, Chazaka, Ein Adam Yis Panav, Bifnei Bal Chovo. That is because we have a Chazaka, that a individual who borrows money will not be so brazen as to deny the loan in front of his creditor. Now again, we'll speak to this in 1 second. The Gemara back on Daf Mem Amud Bet said that people are Meiz Panav Yifnei Bal Chovo, and that was why they instituted Shvuat Haseit. And back there we noted, the Baal Tosfot noted, the Ramban noted, that obviously it means that there still is a reticence to deny it. If I have a choice between admitting to a portion of it or denying the whole thing, I'd much rather admit to a portion than deny the whole thing. So it doesn't mean that a person will never do that. It just means that a person will be more reluctant to do that. And therefore, if they have better options, they will take those options rather than frontally denying against the creditor over here. Now, Rashi claims the reason he won't do that is because asalo tova. He did him a favor and he lent him money. Remember in their day, when you're lending money, it's not with interest. So lending money is a significant investment in that individual. If he believed him and he lent him the money, how could he return that favor by denying the loan? That's Rashi's view of it. The Baal Tosfot disagree with that and say that the problem is that people are unwilling to lie to the face of the person who knows the truth. The creditor knows the truth. The debtor will not lie to his face if he knows the absolute truth. When there's options or questions about the situation, they'll be willing to lie. The big nafkamina between them is with regards to Shomrim, by a pikadon. Rashi writes this in Baba Kama and Baba Metziah, that when it comes to a pikadon, meiz umeiz, that the person will be meiz bifnei the shomer, because the shomer didn't do many tova. It's actually the opposite way around. He did a tova by taking care of the pikadon, of the deposit for the other party. So he has no compunctions about lying, and that means kofer bakol is an open option for a shomer to lie and to lie to the face of this individual because he didn't do him any tova. And that means that he should be believed because it's a migo now. If he's modeh b'miksat in that case, migo that he could have been kofer bakol and instead he was modeh b'miksat, he should be believed. That's Rashi's view, or that's what comes out of Rashi. And then the Baal Tosfot would say that's wrong because they say the reason behind ein adam yis panav bifnei bal chovo is because you can't lie to the face of the person who knows the truth. That will be equally applicable by a shomer. The shomer, the person who deposited the item with you, knows the truth. The shomer will not lie to his face and say that you never deposited the item when he knows the guy knows the truth, that he did deposit the item. And therefore, for the Baal Tosafot, there is, by shomerim, also a chazaka that there will be no kofer bakol, and that means modeh miksat has application by shomerim. Question of whether for shvuat ha-shomrim you need also modeh miksat, or it's enough to have shvuat ha-shomrim without modeh miksat, is a machloket in the Balei HaTosafot on Kuf Zayin in Baba Kama. It's a very, very large Balei HaTosafot over there, and many of the Balei HaTosafot argue. The Rabbeinu Tam, the Rivam, and others argue about what exactly you need to generate a Shvat HaShomrim and how exactly this works. But Bigadol, the machloket between Rashi and the Balei HaTosafot is about what's the reason behind Kol Perbekol, and that has impact as to whether you believe Shomrim are also subject to this Chazakah or not subject to this Chazakah. Behind the Lokafrei, the reason he didn't deny the loan here is Mishum Denimeiz Panav, if Nei Bacholo, because he will not be so brazen as to lie to his creditor, for Rashi's reason, because he owes him a tova for the Balei HaTosafot, because he won't lie to someone who knows the truth. So now he should admit to the whole amount. So why doesn't he admit to the whole amount that he owes? He doesn't have the money to pay now, so he's trying to buy himself time until he can repay the full amount. Until I have enough money to pay him back, I will just admit to a portion of it. The Torah says, we understand this mentality. Put a shvua on this guy, so that he admits to the whole amount, because he's not going to take a shvua checker, the assumption is. And therefore, if he's motive and mixat, there's suspicion about his motives in being motive and mixat. And if we throw a shvua on him, we're going to get to the bottom of this and get the truth out of this. So now, Rabbi Lezer ben Yaakov Savar, lo shna bo, belo shna bibno, enu meiz. It doesn't matter whether it's the original creditor or his son. In neither case will he be meiz panav. Ve'ilkach, la meshiva veidahu. For that reason, he's not considered to be a meshiva veidah. Rabbanon Zavre, bifanavu deenu meiz, abifnei bino, meiz. In front of his father, he would not have been meiz, but in front of the child, he would be me'iz, umidlo me'iz, meshiv aveidahu. The fact that he didn't take up that option makes him into a meshiv aveidah. So what the Gemara here is saying in essence is, the whole idea of modav mixad is because we've taken away the option of kofar bakol. The reason you have to take a shvua by modav mixad is because you didn't have a better claim. Your better claim would have been to deny the whole thing. That avenue is not open to you because ein adam me'iz panav bifnei bal chovol. So once I closed that avenue, you only had one choice. That was be modav mixat. That's why you're not believed. That's why the Torah puts a shvua on you. But if I can open up that avenue of kofar bakol to you, then you would be believed in amigo, which is you had a better claim. You should have denied the whole thing. The fact that you admitted to a portion of it means that you should be believed on amigo. And you could have denied the whole thing, said zero. You said half. That's meshiva veda. That's basically the explanation of modav mixat and why when ein adam is benav v'nei b'chovo, you take away that option, why modav mixat your chayav shvua. But if you can open up the avenue of Bakul for Bakul, then you are believed. And that's what the Gemara says, the Chachamim and Rabbi Lezer ben Yaakov are arguing about. The Chachamim believe that Ein Adam is Be'anav Bifnei Bal Chovo only applies to the person who extended the loan. And that is Rashi says because he did you the Tova. Tosafot says he knows the truth. And so because of those reasons, you would not be Bakul for Bakul. But his son didn't do you the Tova. It was the father. And, according to the Balei HaTosafot, the son doesn't know for certain because it was his father's transaction, not his transaction. Given that, the person would be willing to be kofar bakol. You don't have the chazak of ein adam eiz panav v'nei bakol. It means both options are open to him. Now, if he admits that he owes half, that's kemeshiv aveda. That's like you're lucky that the guy said anything. If he really wanted to, he could have denied the whole thing. If he is saying that it's half, we're going to believe him because he had the option. He had a better way to lie, which is to say it was zero. That's the view of the Chachamim. Blaz Ben Yaakov says, no, that's true, not only by the father, it's also true by the son. Again, for Rashi, that means that just like you feel a certain gratitude towards the father because he lent you the money, that same gratitude extends to the child because he is the offspring of the person who lent you the money and did this tova to you, and you'd be unwilling to be kafui tov towards this quote-unquote family because of what they did for you. Or for the Balei HaTosafot, that just like you wouldn't lie to the creditor himself, you won't lie to the child of the creditor, assuming that the child knows that his father lent you the money, and even though he wasn't there, wasn't part of the transaction, he knows enough to say to you that this is a lie when you deny the whole thing. So in that way, Rabbi Lezer ben Yaakov believes that even the child is empowered in the same way as the father, and that means we just cut off the avenue of kofar bakol to you. Once we cut off the avenue of kofar bakol, motive mix that makes you chayav and eshvua because you don't have the migo, you didn't have another option. Your only option was to go the option of motive mixat. So that's how we explain it. Now going back to the machloket before, according to Rashi and those that believe that a katan has a claim, this is in the case of a katan that's coming making a claim based on the netina of his father. That claim is a nof to generate the necessity for a shvuah, and we still have this concept according to Rabbi Yaakov, and Adam is panav b'fnei bal chovo and bino, and even though it's bino akatan. On the other hand, for the other rishonim who believe that a claim of a katan is meaningless, then the katan's claim is always meshiva bidah. Even Rabbi Ben Yaakov would agree it's meshiva bidah. Here is a case where a gadol, the child who was a gadol, comes and makes the claim. He has a valid claim now. And now you respond to that valid claim. Does Rabbah apply to his claim or not apply to his claim? Again, we'll have to do with how we view a child in the context of a father with regards to this chazakah. So now the Gemara says, Mi matzit mukma kareb lezer ben Yaakov. Can you really set up the Mishnah like Rabbi Lezer ben Yaakov, which is what you're saying now, that the end of the Mishnah is authored by Rabbi Lezer ben Yaakov in this case? Haktani Reisha, the beginning of the Mishnah seems to undermine that. Mana le'ababi adecha. The guy says, my father lent you money, 100 zuz, and the chabiyadi ala 50 dinar. And the debtor responds and says, I only owe 50. Patur, mipnei shemeshiva veidahu. That's patur, because he's a meshiva veidah. So why is it in the ratio of the Mishnah that we say it's meshiva veidah, which sounds like the position of the chachamim, and now you're telling me about the katan that you're taking a shvuah to at the end of the Mishnah, that that's a case where we don't say it's meshiva veidah, and you are chayav. How do I reconcile between those? Mar says, no problem. Hatam de lo amar barili. Hacha de amar barili. Over there, it's a case where he doesn't say, I am certain about the claim. Over here, it's a case where he says, I am certain about the claim. The way Rashi reads this is that in the ratio of the Mishnah, the case where the son comes and says, I think you owe my father 100 zuz. Guy says, I did borrow 100 zuz, but I already paid back 50. I only owe you 50. In that case, even Rabbi Elezer ben Yaakov will agree that that is a tanat safek. That tanat safek does not generate a motive in mixed case. And if he's admitting to half of it, you're lucky because you didn't have a definitive claim. In the latter part of the Mishnah, where it says that when you admit to 50, you're going to have to now give it, take a shvua to the katan, that's the case when the katan says, I know for sure my father gave you 100 zuz. In that case, you have a definitive claim, and in that, Rabbi Elezer ben Yaakov says there is no din of meshiv avedah. Or basically, what Rabbi Elezer ben Yaakov is saying in the Reisha is, where he's not certain about the claim, then kofar bakol is an option for the debtor. Whereas in the Seifa, where he's making a definitive claim, he's saying, I know for sure you owe my father that money, there, kofar bakol is not an option that's open to him. And therefore, in the latter case, in the end of the Mishnah, motive mix-up will generate a shvuah according to Rabbi Elezer ben Yaakov. In the earlier case, it will not generate a shvuah because of the uncertainty of the claim. That's the way Rashi reads it. The Rabbeinu Chananel brings another view, which is, says that the other option, the way to explain this Gemara, is that based not on the creditor's claim or the son of the creditor's claim, but on the debtor's response. And that is, in the case of the Reisha, that's a case where he says, I know for sure I paid back 50 of it. The lay alai elanun. Therefore, he's patur. Seifa is where he says, Sveikali. I'm not sure if I paid back the 50. Fikach ramole shvua kechelodi. In that case, we make him take a shvua in order that he admits. Sounds like he's playing games when he says, yeah, I think I paid back already 50 of it, or I think I repaid it. In that case, we're going to make him take a shvua. So that's another option that's brought by the Rabbeinu Chananel to explain this Gemara Borili. Instead of saying it's about the claimant, it's about the defendant. That ends Rav's answer to this problem about who's the author of a Mishnah. And I had noted before, there's another Amora, Shmuel, who has an alternate view. Shmuel Amar, the Katan. When it says in the Mishnah, you're going to take a Shvua to a Katan, that is Lipara Minichse Katan. That's when you want to collect from the possessions of a Katan. Lehekdesh, when you're going to take a Shvua to Hekdesh, that is Lipara Minichse Hekdesh. If you want to take money away from Hekdesh. So, in a situation in which you have a claim against the father, and you're coming with that claim to the Yitomim to take the money that is owed to you, you must take a Shvua. This is a demand of the Chachamim, that in order to take from orphans, you always have to take a Shvua. We're trying to protect the orphans from claimants coming and saying that you're owed money, or coming with false shtarot, because the Yitomim don't know how to respond. And sometimes we won't even let you take the money until they become older and they can deal with it. Some cases, if you have enough evidence, we'll let you take it, but we're only going to let you take it with a shvua to make up for the deficit of the tanim or the yitomim here who cannot respond to your claim. We need you to make your claim stronger, and how do you do that? That's through a shvua. So what Shmuel says is that when are you taking a shvua to a katan? is not about a case where he's coming with a claim against you. It's actually a case where you're coming with a claim against him. But in order to make your claim valid, you're going to have to take a shwa, and similarly with Hekdesh. Katan li parah minichsei katan tanina. We have a Mishnah that explicitly tells you that already. Minichsei yitomim, if you want to come and collect from yichsei yitomim, lo yipara ela bishvua. You're not allowed to collect except with a shwa. So that's explicit in the fact that you need a shwa to collect from yitomim. Tarte lomali. So then, according to Shmuel, why do I need that? Further on in the Mishnah, and in our Mishnah as well, tell me the same thing, that when you want to take from Tanim, you need to take a Shvua. Hakamash Malan, Abaye Kishisha. That comes to teach us like the older Abaye. Dani Abaye Kishisha, the older Abaye says, Yitomim, Shamru. When we're talking about orphans, Gidolim. We are speaking about those that are of age. Ein Tzarich Lomar, Tanim. That is true for Gdolim, then certainly it's true for Ktanim. Ben the Shvua, Ben the Ziborit. That's for these two items where Ktanim or Yitomim get the advantage. Orphans are given the advantage when claimants come against them in two areas. One is that a claimant can only take from Ziborit, the worst land of the Yitomim. They can't go after the Benonit or Idit, even if they are entitled based on their class of claim. To go after that, they still can only take from Ziborit. Number two is, their claim is only valid if they take a shvua. Now, you would have thought, when we spoke about yitomim, that only means minors, people who are underage. To protect them, we make those demands. That you take only from ziburit, and you only take, only when you take a shvua. But once they become of age, and they can deal with their own matters, maybe over there, you wouldn't have those requirements. And they'd be like any other defendant, and you were a claimant, so then they would have to pay you, and they have to pay you in the class of land that you are deserving. Shmuel's din says, the Mishnah says it twice. One to teach you that it applies by Ketanim, and the other one to teach you it even applies by Yidolim. Even if the Yitomim are of age, you still have to take a Shvua to collect, you still will only get from Ziborit, and that is because, in the end, whether they're Ketanim or Gdolim, the Yitomim are at a huge disadvantage because they were not the counterparty to this transaction. And so we want to protect them against claimants coming and making false claims. We do that by, first of all, saying you're going to collect from the worst land, and number two, by having them take a shvua to substantiate their claim. Then, behekdesh, lipara minichsei hekdesh. So now again, he said, behekdesh, lipara minichsei hekdesh. Says you're going to take to a shvua of hekdesh when you want to collect from hekdesh. Tanina. Again, that's an explicit mishnah. Benechasim mishubadim lo yifru'u ela bishvua. You want to take from encumbered property, you can only do that with shvua. So here's a situation in which the person was makdish all his property. And then a creditor comes and says, I have a prior claim against the property, you have to give me the money. So now he's trying to collect from encumbered property. The property was already given to Hekdesh. It was Mukdash. So now when he wants to come and make a claim, he's making a claim against encumbered property. You want to take out of encumbered property, you have to take a Shvua. So again, to collect from Hekdesh, you're going to have to take a Shvua. And what does Shmuel have to bring you another din? That's a Mishnah already. Umali Mishubadim Lejot, Umali Mishubadim Legva. Why does it matter if they're encumbered to a layperson if they're encumbered to Hekdesh? In either case, you want to take it, you're going to take a Shvua. Itzrich. Savradat chamina edyotu dadamosek nunya al edyot. The reason you have to take a Shvua by edyot is because people collude to cheat lay people. That means that this individual sold all of his property to so-and-so. All of a sudden he says, you know what? I thought up this plan. And I'm going to go get a creditor to come and claim that there was a loan outstanding beforehand and he has a right to this property. And his right to this property stems from a previous loan. But there really was no loan. What he does is he goes to another guy, one of his friends, and says, let's write up a document that you lent me money. We'll predate it to the transaction where I sold the property. We'll go and make the creditor claim, and then we'll split the land between us. And then we'll make up. So you would think that type of collusion people would only do when it comes to a layperson who bought the property. About like this. When it comes to Hekdesh, in Adam will say, Kununya al Hekdesh. People don't collude to cheat Hekdesh. It's one thing to cheat a fellow man. It's another thing to cheat God. So people aren't going to collude against God. Kamash Malan, the people cheat God too. So that people are equal opportunity. If they're going to cheat people, they will also cheat God as well. And they'll collude in both of these cases. So the two Mishnayot teach you both that we need to make you take a Shvua when you're coming to collect against a lay person. And we also make you take a shvua when you come to collect against Hekdesh. And that teaches you that they're on equal footing in terms of collusion. Gemara says, is that really true? Amar Rav Huna, Shchiv Meira, Shikdish Kol Nechasav. A person who's laying on his deathbed and says that he sanctified, gave to Hekdesh all of his property. Vamar, but he does say, Maneh Leploni Biyadi. I do owe 100 zuz to so-and-so. So here's, this is a classic case of where you would say, you should have to take a shvuah to substantiate that claim. Naman, his belief. The reason being is that a person doesn't collude to cheat hekdesh. Amre, hani milei shchimera. That's only true by a person on his deathbed. Dein adam chute v'lo lo. Because a person doesn't sin when he's not a beneficiary. Aval gabi bari v'day chashinen. But if he's healthy, we worry about it. The only reason to collude with the other party is because you're going to split the spoils of what you get. So here, a person will say, I'll collude against Hekdesh with this other party, because we'll split whatever land I get out of Hekdesh. And therefore, it's beneficial for me to sin because I'm getting something out of it. Then when he's on his deathbed, and he colludes with this other guy to steal from Hekdesh, the only beneficiary is going to be the other guy. He's not going to be around to benefit from that collusion against Hekdesh. He's about to pass away. That's the concept of Ein Adam Choteh V'lo Lo. Person doesn't sin when it's not for his benefit, and that means that even for his children's benefit, he won't sin. He'll sin when he is the beneficiary. If his children are the beneficiaries, he's not going to sin. He's not going to cheat Hekdesh. For that reason, a Shechimira is believed in that case, and he will not collude against Hekdesh. But a healthy person will collude against Hekdesh, and he'll have to take a Shuah to collect against Hekdesh. Right, next Mishnah. These are the items where a person will not have to take a Shuah. Havadim, Vashtarot, Vakarakot, Vayekdeshot. The truth is that the Gemara will go through each one of these, but we already know that from earlier in the Masechta, that we have a Klal Upratu Klal that teaches you that these items are excluded because it's only something that is Davar Mil Teltel, so that it can be carried in Gufo Mamon and has inherent value to it. And Hekdesh is precluded because the word Re'eyu is used in the Psukim. Not only do these items that we just mentioned here, Avadim, Shtarot, Karkod, and Hekdeshot, they don't have a Shvua, they also ain't Be'em Tashlume Kefel, below Tashlume Arba V'Chamisha, they're not subject to having double payment made in Gneva cases. They're not subject to Arba V'Chamisha. Shomer Chinam Enu Nishba. If a claim is made against the Shomer Chinam and he claims Gneva V'Veda, that Shomer Chinam will not take a Shvua on these items, even though normally a Shomer Chinam, in order to release himself, would have to take a Shvua. Noseh Sechar Enu Mishalim. And a higher Shomer also will not have to pay. The whole Parshia of Shomrim is precluded from this. And as the Bali Tosafot point out over here, they just gave the example of Shomer Chinam and Shvua and Nusu Sechar and Tashlumim, because they're the first two in the Parshia there. And the first one is the Shomer Chinam taking a Shvua, and the other one is the Shomer Sechar, who is Chayav for Gneva Veda. But it would be equally applicable that if a Shomer Sechar was the case of Ones, then he also would not have to take a Shvua. Or if it was the case of a Shoel, where he's Chayav to pay, he would also not have to pay in all these items, because they're all mufka from the parsha of Shomrim. And Tosafot points out that even though it's true by all these Shomrim, the reason that the Mishnah did not mention Sheila is because Sheila is not relevant by Hekdesh. Nobody borrows from Hekdesh. You can borrow these items from other lay people, but borrowing from Hekdesh is not relevant. And even though, as the Bali Tosafot will point out, that by Tashlumei Daud Vehei, it's not relevant by Plita, stealing it and shechting it is not relevant by the case of Karkaot, Shtarot, or by Avadim, because Shechita is only relevant by animals, Shor Vaseh. Nevertheless, it still brought Dal V'Hei down, because Dal V'Hei can be manifest in two ways. One way is through Shechita, the other way is through Mechira. He stole it and sold it, then he subject Dal V'Hei, and that is applicable to all the cases. That's why it brought Dal V'Hei down, but She'ilah was left out, because it's not relevant by Hekdesh. And Tosafot goes as far as to say, if you borrowed a house, and it burnt down, you would be Patur. Even though a Shoel is Chayav on everything, that's considered to be Karkaot. And borrowing a house or renting a house is considered to be like Karka, a transaction about Karka. And if Karka is Mufka from the Parshat HaShomrim, then you're going to be Patur. Although the Gra points out that he thinks that there are many opinions that disagree with this Bali HaTosafot, and that they say that in that case you will be Chayav, and it's not deemed to be Karka enough to be Mafkia you from the Parsha of Shomrim. And therefore, if you borrowed a house and it burnt down, you would be responsible for the house. So that obviously has large nafkaminot, again, with regards to people renting houses, that if you rent a house or borrow a house, what's the status in terms of your culpability in that case? According to Bali Tosafot, the culpability is gone unless you state specifically and you make him chayav, but under Parshat HaShomrim, it's going to be gone. Whereas others believe you're still chayav in that case. Tosafot goes as far as to say that even if a Shomer Sechar is pusheya, that he would be patur over here, because again, he's completely mufka from the parsha. Although this view of the Balei Tosafot, that a poshea would even be patur here, is negated by the Rambam. The Rambam says, Yirali, shim pasha shomer ba'avadim ekuyotzben, chayav v'shalem, she'en patur ba'avadim ekarkot v'shtarot, elamidin g'neva v'aveda, umeita ekuyotzben. But if you are a poshea, you are in a different group, and that is because poshea is not like a regular din of failure in shumrim, but rather, you flip into a different category. You're no longer a shomer or part of the world of shomrim. You now go into the world of hezek. You've done damage. And therefore, and there's no difference between whether you damage property or you damage metaltalin, you're chayav. And everybody who understands this knows that this is right. That's the right way to go. And that's the way my Rabbeim Paskin, that Amoser Karmol Shomer Ben Barisud Ben Mishmirot Chinam Bitnaimo Shiachbor Yazmor Yavek Mishalo Pasha Velo Asa, and he was Poshe and didn't do it. Chayav Kemishi Ifsid Biyadayim, because it's equivalent of as if you damage with your own hands. Chen Kol Yosef Zeshi Ifsid Biyadayim Chayav Al Kol Panim. As you can imagine over here, the Rambam disagrees with this, and he says, Ve'emetu, if what the Rambam is really saying is true, Shomachimam, lama einu nishba, alta anato shlo pasha. Then why doesn't a Shomachinam take a shvua on the fact that he wasn't posheya? Shreim pasha, mishalei. Because according to you, the Rambam, if a Shomachinam was posheya, he would end up having to pay. So why doesn't he have to take, when he takes a shvua, saying that he was ganav ba'avad, should also have to take a shvua that he wasn't posheya? Vein posheya mazik? Shim kein haya pshia bebalim? Lama patur? El shein posheya domei lemazik klal. And he says, if you were right that a posheya is like a mazik, then posheya bebalim, which is one of the exemptions by she'ela, and according to many rishonim, by other shomrim as well, then if the balim are there, if he's a posheya, why should that exempt him from payment? He's a mazik. Ella, the Rambam concludes that a posheya is not a mazik, and he disagrees with the Rambam. The Torah brings down the shita of the Rambam, and then says his father, the Rosh, disagreed with the Rambam, and held by the Balei Tosafot, and the Beit Yosef brings both opinions down, but says since the Rif, and the Rosh, and the majority of Rishonei all agree that posheya is patur, he paskins against the Rambam in this case, because the Rambam is in the minority against the majority of poskim, who believe that posheya is not chayav by karka, shtarot, avadim, and hekdesh. The other thing that the Balei Tosafot spent a lot of time on, again, it's not so relevant to our Gemara here, but rather back to the cases in Perek Meruba, which is that over there there's a machloket as to whether the two parshiot of Gneva are both speaking about Toein Tanat Ganav, or one of them is speaking about a Ganav, and one of them is speaking about Toein Tanat Ganav. If you believe that one of them is speaking about a Ganav, and one of them is speaking about Toein Tanat Ganav, then you could have a case that would be relevant in these items without a shvua. But if you believe that both parshiot are speaking about Toein Tanat Ganav, and you need a shvua by Toein Tanat Ganav to be chayav, that means there's no way to be chayav in terms of these items, except if you took a shvua. If you're already precluded from a shvua, then by definition, you're also precluded from the cases of kefel. Never the Balei Tosafot is perplexed, according to the one who says that both parshiot are speaking about Toein Tanat Ganav. Why do you need two limudim over here? One for shvua and one for kefel. If by definition, if you can't take a shvua, you'll never get to kefel. Tosafot gives a number of answers. One answer is, Yesh lamar, it's strictly echa, then it chayav lo shvua, didei gilgul. You need it for the time or the case where he's chayav eshwa ayidei gilgul. So the shwa didn't come about because of the claim here, but it came about from another claim, and therefore you're taking a shwa on these items, which is possible. But then, why do you need re'eyu to exclude ekdesh from kefel? Because there's no such thing as gilgul shwa by ekdesh. So he runs into the problem again. He says, v'yesh lamar v'lamaskana d'resh mirube, that based on the conclusion of the Gemara in Bava Kamma, lekel achad klal upratu klal ashvua v'kefel. So he answers the problem in by saying that this limud for shvua and kefel derive from the same place. And therefore, when you learn one, you learn the other automatically from each other, and there really are not two different limudim, one for kefel and one for shvua, even though the Gemara seems to indicate here and there that there are. The conclusion of the Gemara there is that there's only one limud that comes from the same pasuk, both for Shvua and Kefil, and now it's not a problem. Because yeah, if you're Mufra from Shvua, you're also Mufra from Kefil, but they all derive from the same thing. It's not that you can't get to Kefil without a Shvua. The same source gives you the din for both of them. And the Baal HaTosafot does well point out in a similar vein that even though the Gemara here is going to say it's a klal uprat uklal, the Gemara in Merubah concludes that it's a riboy miut to riboy, even though it ends you in the same place. Nevertheless, it's a different form of limut. And the Baal HaTosafot says sometimes the Gemara just calls riboy miut to riboy klal uprat uklal to say to you it's that type of limut. Doesn't mean it's really klal uprat uklal, just that type of limut, and you'll figure out whether that's klal uprat uklal or riboy miut to riboy, and that's what the Gemara is doing when it explains this mission over here. Rabbi Shimon Omer, kodeshim shechaya b'achriyutam nishba'im aleihem. If you have kodeshim, which are not yours, and you are responsible for them, then you're going to take a shvua on it. She'enu chaya b'achriyutam, if you're not responsible for them, ein nishba'im aleihem. You do not take a shvua on it. So Rabbi Shimon's position derives from two things. One is that when you're makdish something, there are different ways to makdish it. One is a nidava, which is that you are giving it to Ekdesh, and it goes into Ekdesh's position, and you have no responsibility, and there's no recourse against you. It's now in Ekdesh's position, possession. If it doesn't get to them, if it doesn't get taken care of, that's not your problem. The other way to do that is through a neder, where you obligate yourself to provide to Ekdesh, you obligate yourself to bring the korban. In that case, if the animal that you separated out disappears, you're going to have to replace it, because the obligation's on you, not on the animal itself. In that case, then if something happens where somebody steals the animal, there's actually real money being lost over here, because you're going to have to replace the animal. And that's what's called davar ha-goreim le-mamon. Rabbi Shimon believes davar ha-goreim le-mamon, something that precipitates a monetary obligation, has the same status as a monetary obligation, and therefore you will take a shvua on it, because it's no longer under the realm of Hekdesh. It's now under the realm of a layperson, because he's now responsible to replace it. It's a goreim le-mamon for this layperson, and therefore you're going to be responsible to take it. Then you have to take a shvua if you do any of these things to it. There's some things that are attached to the ground, but they don't have a status of being karka. And the chachamim disagree with that. Ketzad, what's the situation? Eser gfanim to unot. You have 10 vines that are covered in grapes. They are loaded with grapes. Misarti lecha, that's what I gave to you. And the other guy says 5. That's a modeh b'miksad case. Rabbi Meir mechayev shvua. Rabbi Meir says you are chayev shvua. Anything attached to the ground is considered like the ground. And you don't take a shvua on karka. So even though there's a modeh b'miksad, you're not going to take a shvua over here. Rabbi Meir, as we'll see in the Gemara, doesn't disagree fundamentally with that. He disagrees in a case where they are omedli batzer, where they're already so ripe that they're ready to be picked, and they no longer need to be attached to the ground. What is their status? Rabbi Meir says they're considered detached already. Chachamim say they are considered still to be karka. Ein nishvayim elo davar shemimida b'shkalu minyan. You only take a shvua, at least the modeh b'miksad, when you're speaking about definitive items, things that can be measured. That means whether by weight, number, or size, quantity, that is the way that you can be chayav a shvua modeh miksad. Ketzad, bayit malei masarti lecha. Says I gave you a house full of stuff. Bekis malei masarti, or I gave you a pocket, it really means a wallet or a pouch full of stuff. Balomer, any yodeya. Eliyahu says, I don't know. Elamasha nachta atanotel. Whatever you gave me, I'm handing back to you. Patur. He's patur there because you did not give a definitive size, quantity, weight to the item that you are making a claim for. Zeomer ad aziz, the guy says, I gave you a house full of stuff, and it went up to that protrusion in the house. Zeomer ad achalon, the guy says, no, it was only filled up to the window, then you're chayav. Because there you gave a definitive marking, or quantity, or measurement of what you are claiming. Malay, full, doesn't have any quantity. Full can mean different things in different contexts. Full is not a definitive claim. A claim where you give a demarcation and the other person argues with that demarcation, that's a quantity where you can have a modeh b'miksad, and that ends up with a shvua where you'll be chayav for modeh b'miksad. Just to remember, when we spoke yesterday about shvuat hasseit, that relates to this Mishnah. The Mishnah says here there's no shvua on karka vadim shtar and ekdesh. Many of the unim and rishonim, as we saw yesterday, still believe that there is a shvuat hasseit on these items. We saw the differing opinions as to whether yes or no, although everybody agrees that by Hekdesh, there is no Shvuat HaSeit, because Hekdesh is mufka completely from the parsha, and that's what we saw in Rav Hai going yesterday. Tashlumei Kefel Minolan. How do we know that Tashlumei Kefel, that these items are not relevant? The Tan Rabbanan. Al Kol Davar Pesha Klau. Al Shor Al Chamor Vasev Al Salma Prat. Al Kol Aveda Chazar VeKlau. Klau Uprat UKlau. Iatadan Alakena Prat. When you have this set up, only things that are included are things that are similar to the Pratim. Ma Prat Mifurash Davar Mitaltel BeGufo Mamol. Just like the Pratim over there, the common denominator between them is that they are Mitaltel, movable objects, not real property. And Gufo Mamon, they have inherent value to them. So too, anything that is a movable item and has inherent value to it, that will be included in the Parsha of Kefel. Yatsu Karkaot Shein Metalteleen, that excludes Karka, which is real property and fixed, doesn't move. Yatsu Avedim Shukshu the Karkaot, Avedim, which are always compared to Karka, have the same din as Karka, they're considered to be like real property. Yatsu Shtarot Shabbi Shein Metalteleen, even though they are movable objects, in Gufan Mamon. They don't have inherent value to them. Hekdesh Re'euktim. The case there says Re'eu. And by Re'eu, Re'eu means your fellow layman, not Hekdesh. And therefore it's precluded, even though the Gemara in Ruba learns it out from Gonei Be'beit Ha'ish. Be'beit Ha'ish, V'lo Mi'beit Hekdesh. Tosfot here says that that was just the beginning of a pasuk, but they really learned it out of the word Re'eu over here. V'lo Arba V'chamisha, my daima. What's the reason that doesn't apply to Arba Chamisha? Tashlumei Arba Chamisha, my Rachmana, below Tashlumei Shlusha Barba. The Torah says you have to pay 4 or 5 times, not 3 and 4 times. What the Gemara is noting here and spends a lot of time in Meruba about is that Arba Chamisha is really made up of Kefel plus 3 and 4 times. So if you already took out Kefel, then all that's left is 3 and 4 times. And the Torah says 4 or 5 times, not 3 and 4 times. And once you're out of the Parsha of 4 or 5 times, you're precluded completely from that Parsha. Okay, we're going to stop here by the 2 dots on the bottom of Membet, Amud Bet.